Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
They're going to save it. They'll never let the markets go down. And the effect of that is guess what? You're not putting your trust in the mechanics of the market, of supply and demand, and the facts that are taking place on the ground. You're putting your trust in someone's ability to continue to manipulate the markets. And there's forces outside their control that are going to, you know, come home to roost.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this Finance U episode. Back with Paul Kiker this week. And about 1 month into the Iran war, and markets don't seem to have really caught up to that yet. We're going to go over some of the data now, but guess what? Inflation is in the pipeline. So, Paul, are you ready for a romping discussion today?
I am. And it's April Fool's Day, so we won't pull any jokes on it for sure at all.
Nope. But no, I had an April Fool's joke. I'm not going to do it. All right, let's start here. So this just came out in Bloomberg yesterday, today being the 1st of April when this is being recorded. And this is an interview with FGE Nexan ECA chairman Emeritus. And he's talking here about where oil prices could go. And you can see in the ticker right behind him, like, oh, look, Brent's down $1.38. But he says oil may spike to 200. Here's his thinking. He said oil may surge to 150 or 200 a barrel if the near closure of the Strait of Hormuz persists over the next 6 to 8 weeks because of the Iran war. Every week, he says, 100 million barrels of oil is not going through the Strait. And every month, 400 million barrels are not going through. So within a period of time, he said, these losses to the market will be astronomical. It's pretty clear at this point, Paul, everybody who's been tracking the oil markets knows now that there's somebody has been in there selling it short on the paper side. There were rumors that Japan was going to do that because they found out they could just drive the price down by playing the U.S. paper game, drive the paper price of oil down, and that would help them actually make the price of oil cheaper that they could then secure for themselves. What do you think about this idea that we can just take a physical commodity and wang its price around using paper?
Well, you know, when I saw that rumor coming out of Japan, I'm like, why didn't I think of that before? Like, they're experts at financialization of the market and manipulation from that standpoint based on what their central bank has done over the past 20, 30 years. But, you know, it reminds me, and I've got the quote here, that it's artificial, right? I mean, they can do it for a period of time. And that's one thing if you're juicing the markets and the markets are going up and liquidity is increasing and it's feeding itself. But the problem in doing it with the physical commodities is that's just going to exacerbate the problem down the road. You know, what is it? The Malaysian proverb says that don't think there are no crocodiles because the water is calm. And what they're doing is trying to calm the markets, but then those crocodiles are lurking that are going to come up at some point in the future because you can't replace that demand. You can't replace that supply in the interim period. There's going to be a crunch. You can paper it over, but that's a dishonest market. And I guess the April Fool's joke would be today, you know, hey, we all of a sudden have honest markets because they're not. This outside hand is in there trying to manipulate for short-term benefit, which is just going to be much more painful for those that are paying attention to price, because price is supposed to be, you know, relevant of truth. But when you've got that hidden hand, you're eliminating the ability for the demand to reduce in the interim period to kind of help deal with that price and people to prepare for it. It's just foolish.
Yeah, I had this a little later, but I skipped forward. We might as well talk about it now, because this is the most important chart you get in business school, economics 101, the PQ chart, price and quantity. And so demand and supply, as we can see here, so this is your demand curve, here's your supply curve, and where those two things meet, that's going to be where your price is going to settle out. So let's imagine now that demand starts to go higher and higher up this curve, what's happening to price? Well, it's going higher and higher. And additionally, if all of a sudden we got a lot of supply coming into the market, we would see the price coming down. So this is how it's supposed to balance out. We don't have a market clearing price right now, though, for one of the most important commodities. Listen, Paul, I know they've gotten used to like setting, you know, being clever with paper markets for setting currencies, bonds, stocks, gold and silver, you know, all of that. Oil's different. It comes out of the ground and we burn it. We set it on fire. And so it's you can play with that a little bit for a while, but it's not like any of those other things I mentioned. Those you can play with almost indefinitely. Oil's different. It comes out of the ground and we set it on fire and it gets burned, right? So that, I think, Paul, they've got at most another month of doing this, but then when, not if, but when the price quantity chart blows up on them, the price is going to go up very quickly, very, very quickly at that point in time. I don't think anybody's ready for that. And the market is not pricing that in at all. And by the way, it isn't just this one guy talking about this. U.S. officials are now talking about a potential for $150 per barrel for oil. That's according to Politico. So I don't see any other way. I think we're going to have much higher oil prices in the future. And you would think you would see that get priced in a little bit. Airline stocks should be getting hit, cruise lines, shipping lines, trucking firms. There's all kinds of things you would expect to see an impact on. I haven't really seen it yet in the financial market prices.
No.
So far.
No, I haven't seen it in the financial market prices either. And, I mean, we started to sell off a little bit. We broke some pretty major support last Thursday and last Friday for the S&P and the NASDAQ, for a lot of your Mag 7 stocks. And then, of course, on cue, you've got Trump comes out on Monday pre-market, makes the announcement. And, you know, in really perfect timing, because we're at the end of the month, you've got first of month money flows. I mean, there are some strategies out there that they only invest on the last day of the month and they exit on the fifth or sixth day of the month, and then they go to shorter term treasuries or other. I mean, it is a big deal that passive money starts coming in. So we were already set up for a short squeeze. So, I mean, they basically lit the fuel here in the interim period, and the market's just mechanically reacting without any regard for the knock-on effects of what's taking place.
Trump did it again here on April Fool's Day. He came out this morning about an hour before market open, maybe just a half hour before, and he said that Iran has just asked the United States of America for a ceasefire. And, of course, this, you know, it's a pump the market kind of a thing. And he always does this right before market open, right? People have started to notice. Mm-hmm. But all you have to do is usually wait about an hour. And of course, Iran's foreign ministry came out and said, quote, no truth to Trump's statements that we requested a ceasefire. And this is how it's been for a couple of weeks now. Trump says Iran's begging for something. Iran comes out and says, no, we're not. And I trust actions more than words. I've been noticing no let up in the bombing. We just lost another tanker this morning to a missile fire. There was one the day before yesterday. So there's still tankers blowing up all over the place. There's infrastructure getting hit. There's bombing raids in Iran. Other things are happening. So it's a hot war right now.
Yes, it is. Well, and yesterday Ukraine hit a major oil facility in Russia, right?
Yeah, again, so, I mean, another one.
Yeah, another one. So, I mean, there's just these consistent impacts on that infrastructure, and that infrastructure is going to take time to rebuild. I mean, that's not something, it's not like the COVID shutdown where, okay, everybody's staying at home and oil goes negative. I know there were some issues in there in the interim period, but as soon as they open it back up, you know, then all of a sudden it's flowing again, it's getting where it needs to go. This is different because you're losing the infrastructure. And that's what amazes me, that the market's not taking that into consideration at this point, that it's, hey, just headline driven, an excuse to buy. And I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, we're at the part of the cycle where it's the most dangerous, because investors are fully convinced, like Pavlov's dog. I mean, think about it. Ever since the Great Crisis in 2008, major printing money, And then I remember the Tepper Bottom because it was Operation Twist, if I remember. That was around 2011, 2012. Then it was QE1, QE2, QE3. Then they name it something else. It's just consistently injecting capital into the markets. And the majority of the time it happened when you had those technical breakdowns. So the timing was interesting because it's like all of a sudden, any of you that are prudent, any of you that have strategies that are designed to protect your capital, we're going to punish you at the moment that you're supposed to make a decision to, as a fiduciary, to reduce that risk in the portfolio. So, you know, what do you do? Do you put 100% of your faith that they're going to be able to save this all the time? Or do you recognize the fact and embrace wisdom that they've made the system ever more fragile? And they've also taught the individual who's looking for what they want to see that, hey, they're going to save it. They'll never let the markets go down. And the effect of that is guess what? You're not putting your trust in the mechanics of the market, of supply and demand, and the facts that are taking place on the ground. You're putting your trust in someone's ability to continue to manipulate the markets. And there's forces outside their control that are going to, you know, come home to roost,
well,
right?
So I pointed this out before. I thought for sure by now we would get a break in this pattern you've been talking about, where I noted, and I've noted consistently, these are stock futures this morning. I think these are 3-minute candles. This was taken at 7:48 a.m. here Eastern time. Look at the Dow Jones, the S&P 500, the Nikkei, the Euro stocks, NASDAQ, Russell, DAX, right? Just blur your eyes a little. They're almost exactly the same chart. Now, you would think you'd start to get some separation here because Europe's in a very different pickle than we are. Japan's in a very different pickle than Europe. And we're all in different sorts of pickles at this point in time. But look at the stock markets trading tick for tick, identically the same.
Mm-hmm.
So we noted that this had happened before the war. But even here, Paul, with this obvious, easily discerned difference across these markets, they trade as a single organism right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't trust that, you know? That's not a market. That's in control of something else. I don't know. Is it just too much liquidity in computers? It's algos that are really insensitive. Like, these algos, Paul, may drive these markets to new highs after every human, you know, dies in a giant meteor accident or something, right? I don't know what's going on here, but this is not conforming to reality right now. This is dancing to some other tune.
And there's no prudence in that. There's just hindsight bias and the assumption that what happened in the past is going to continue to happen in the future until it doesn't. And look, they've kicked this can down the road longer than many very wise individuals anticipated it. But then those individuals have learned to play the game by the rules that are forced upon them, but at the same time, not relaxed in their responsibility to try to educate people and warn people that, look, we don't know when this thing's going to end, but when it ends, it's not going to end well. And for the people who have placed their trust in the wrong place and in that passive stance are going to be damaged severely. They're going to be damaged severely. Because, look, I mean, you know, we've been talking about, I've been encouraging people, hey, use the resources you can, stock up on some food, you know. We were going to not plant a garden this year, decided that, hey, we're going to plant a garden because that's a prudent thing. You can clearly see the knock-on effects that it's probably going to increase food prices relatively dramatically down the road because of the lack of fertilizer coming in. But the problem is when you hide those signals and allow it to gradually move so that the market can anticipate it, and you're trying to stamp that down for political short-term purposes, You're removing the signals to allow people to prepare for themselves individually, and you have a much less resilient society.
Somebody asked me, Paul, the other day. They like, do you think are they suppressing the markets just, you know, to for our benefit, in the sense of like we wouldn't want people getting panicky or something? It's like you know, they're doing it because it's important that the crowds out there, the populace, doesn't, I don't know, get the wrong ideas or become panicky. And I'm like, that would assume that they have a benefit in mind for us. I don't think it's that. I don't think they're doing that so that we have a more calm experience in life. I think they're doing it so that we don't have a chance to prepare for ourselves. If we're blinded by that, and, you know, we've been conditioned to believe, well, if things were actually that bad, the markets would be showing it for sure, right? And as I've just demonstrated, the markets show whatever the computers demonstrate at this point in time. So I don't think that they're maintaining these manipulations because they think on balance it's a good thing for everybody. I think it has more to do with this. Did you see this cartoon yet? For people just listening, it's a single panel cartoon. The headline is the next big Iran war announcement. They're at the White House press room, and this woman's looking around the corner saying, "What are we waiting for?" And everybody behind there is on their phone saying, "Everybody has to get their trades in."
I did see that, and I literally sat, I laughed out loud at first, and then I just grieved that, you know, there's always some truth in comedy, some bit of truth, and especially in satire. It's amazing. You read the Babylon Bee headlines from time to time, you're like, man, this looks like real news, right? Yeah. But, I mean, that's just sad. Like, everybody knows that we know that they're taking advantage of their inside information on this, and that's just sad. It broke my heart when I saw it, quite frankly.
Yeah, I have to laugh about it because it's not great. All right, Paul, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we have to talk about this inflationary beast that's coming, and boy, it's coming. So be back in just a sec. Markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions. All right, welcome back, everybody. Paul, I want to talk about inflation. So we're starting to see all kinds of signs around this at this point in time, like this, right? So Maersk, one of the biggest container shipping firms in the world, say they have introduced a temporary emergency bunker surcharge due to fuel issues, costs, and mix, which are not included already in the fossil fuel fee. So this is an additional surcharge right now, and that's going on top. It should be noted that containers going from, say, Denmark to Asia, those container shipping rates, I think, have gone up about 140% so far. Now, there's fuel surcharges. There's all kinds of chaos in the shipping lines right now. There's whole regions, Paul, where they don't know if they have enough bunker fuel, which is what they put in ships, enough bunker fuel to resupply the ships. So some ships aren't taking trips. This thing is normally a very tightly choreographed dance, and now it's been thrown into a little bit of chaos. So that's part of the cost increase, but this is all part of everything that you buy that's imported, which is a lot of stuff, now has a surcharge on top of it. That's what I call the pig in the python, that inflationary impulse. Those are costs that are going to get passed on to the consumers, who ultimately always has to pay for these things.
Yes, they are. In a period of time where what's taking place in private equity, I think it was Buffett came out yesterday and said something along the lines of, you know, there is interconnectedness between the private equity space and the banking system. So you've got lack of liquidity and that, you know, in the backdrop, and then these increased prices, you know, that could hit consumers in a lot of areas.
Well, it is, and there's two sides to this. Remember that PQ chart, supply, demand, and then price. We're already starting to see demand destruction coming in. Mm-hmm. And this was some of the first signs we saw. That Telegraph is reporting that thousands of flights have been canceled as jet fuel costs soar. So some of it is yes, it costs more, but in some cases they're actually talking, Paul, now about actual shortages. So So this is true demand destruction. And when we say thousands of flights are canceled, that means that those airlines didn't earn any revenue on those assets for that period of time. It means whoever was on that flight didn't go take a trip, didn't get business done, didn't go home to see family. That economic activity is gone. Whatever goes in the holds of those planes, whatever cargo is being carried from place to place, didn't go. So this is actually a very easily identified piece of demand destruction going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who are thinking about this, Che Boz writes very well about these things over on X. And he wrote here, quote, European airports have urged airlines to prepare contingency plans for a potential complete lack of aviation fuel in the coming weeks. So I think that's, you know, you should have a plan. What's your plan? Carrying on, quote, thousands of flights have already been canceled across the continent amid the escalating crisis. Lufthansa is reportedly considering suspending operations of around 20 aircraft, not flights, aircraft. And they are usually flying multiple legs per day, right? And according to aviation analytics firm Cirium, more than 1 in 20 scheduled flights was canceled just on Monday. And meanwhile, as he says, the UK is expected to receive its final shipment of aviation fuel from the Middle East this week, with no further deliveries confirmed in the immediate pipeline. Aviation industry analyst Alex Macheras has warned that a serious jet fuel shortage could hit all major European airports within a week. And he noted that airports are already informing airlines to prepare for scenarios where no fuel is available. End quote. How is that not sending shockwaves through the markets?
I just wanted to pull up and look. You know, I just happened to pull up and look at one airline without saying their name, and the stock's up substantially over the past couple of days. That's something that, you know, less revenue or less flights, less revenue, the market should be sniffing that out in some manner, but apparently it's not at this point.
How interesting. So again, we talked about this last time. I have that pre-COVID feeling. Remember February? Markets are just sort of like do-do-do-do-do-do, right? You know, into early March, do-do-do. And then whoosh, right? Once the markets caught up. When did the markets stop being intelligent? When did they stop being able to sniff things out?
Boy, I wish I could pick up the phone and call Mike Green and ask him that point right now, because he's the indexing master, right?
Yep.
I'm sure if I thought hard enough, he has defined talked about a point where passive takes over. But this is a good example for anybody who's taking a passive investing approach right now. You know, passive is completely insensitive to any information that you have coming in, right? Any information in the future, because it's looking at the past and assuming that the future is going to be that case. So if you're buying an S&P 500 index fund through your 401k at this point, your monthly contributions are going in depending upon when the company sends them out. Typically, it's going to be on Thursday, first day of the month. Sometimes they do it biweekly. But the reality is, you're going to buy those airlines that are in that S&P 500 index, regardless of the fact that we're being warned that there's going to be shortages in the future, because it is passive. You're buying that entire mix across the S&P 500, whatever percentages goes in there. Of course, larger amount in the cap weighted that goes into the Mag 7 at this point. But I think that's the problem with the market. You know, the intervention, and I hate to say it, but in our industry, has moved to a centralization, right? So the big investment firms, they want their financial planners to be salespeople, financial advisors, right? They know very good about how to do calculations, estate planning, you know, all of that. But none of them know anything about the money management model anymore. And your traditional active managers are a disappearing breed because of the intervention in this major bull market that we've been through. And this is just a classic example of the risk associated with passive investing, is you've got money flow that's buying those regardless. In the good old days, you had active money managers that would get that money in, and they look and say, okay, it's clear that on the path we're on, we're going to have some major issues with these airline stocks. So not only are we not going to buy them, we're going to reduce our exposure in our actively managed portfolio. So I don't know when that threshold crossed, but at this point, you know, it's clear to see that passive money you know, has no regard, and there's not enough active managers to impact it yet. Now, one thing that Mike Green talks about, is on the other side of this, when those liquidations start or layoffs get enough to where people have to start pulling out, it's going to distort it in the exact opposite direction just as heavily as it distorted it to the upside. So I don't know when that line crossed. I'm going to do some research on that and find out, because I know he mentioned his theory of when that crossed at some point, but I can't remember exactly when that was.
And of course, Wall Street just loves that passive flows, right? Because that's just money coming in. Right. It's constant. And then they get to make fees off of that. Maybe they get to front run it. You know, when all that money comes in, that's, you know, automatic, passively, it's going to buy those airlines. I'll bet you anything, there's some prop desks that are happily selling them a bunch of airline stocks they happen to have sitting on the shelf.
That's right. That's right. I mean, look, if you're a hedge fund and you're overweight in that category, this is the perfect opportunity to push it into the market and reduce your positions right now.
This is really important, okay? When you take energy out of the equation, everything changes, right? Because all economic activity requires work, right? And all work requires energy. So let's get rid of that middle part. The economy runs on energy, right? So everything we think about, every economic transaction you can think of, I can show you how energy is in there. Somebody had to get up, drive a car, move something, make something. Something happened, right? And that's work. So when we think about that, right now the current estimates are that about 12 million barrels per day of oil production is missing in action. Now, here's the data for that very quickly. The last reading we had was for the full month for the whole world was that I have is in December. So 86 million barrels per day of just crude and condensate. There's some more on top of that, gets us up to 103, 104 million barrels, but that's not oil. They put it in there, that's petroleum, right? That includes natural gas liquids and stuff. That's not what the world runs on. The world runs on what's called C+C, crude and condensate. So it was at 86 million barrels, and we just took off 12. So, that brings us to 74. Paul, when's the last time the world was burning, outside of COVID, when's the last time the world was burning 74 million barrels of oil? And it was somewhere between 2005 and 2011. So let's say 2011. If we said, wow, this is going to be a sustained outage, the world is going to have to figure out how to conduct about as much economic activity as it did in 2011. I just need to point out that the world's economy was 36% smaller in 2011. So when we say demand destruction, here's what I can't do. I can't predict where or how exactly that's going to fall because it's a complex system. Humans will make decisions that I can't guess. So we'll carefully preserve some things and we'll let other things go. But point is that the world, this is an energy shock unlike any other. We have nothing we can compare it to. Not the 70s, not 2022 when, you know, we had the Russian thing kick off. Nothing has been like this because this is actual destruction of supply.
Mm-hmm.
It's gonna impact everything. Just will.
So let me ask you this, Chris, and this is what I'm really struggling that the market's missing. There's been shipping ports, right, that have been destroyed, pipelines that have been destroyed, complete production. What is it, Qatar or Bahrain that had the liquid natural gas that's going to be 3 to 5 years in estimates before it's up fully operational again?
Yep.
So with this material destruction that's taking place, what's your best estimate in the time that it would take them to be able to bring it back to full production if it stopped today?
Well, it gets tricky. So this isn't just an oil shock. We keep talking about an oil shock. This is also a natural gas shock. And that's also makes it different from anything in the past, right? We had the Arab oil embargo 73. We really didn't even have any LNG back then as a substance. Now the world runs on LNG and they got very comfortable with it. So comfortable that Taiwan dismantled its nukes and shut down a lot of things and just ran on basically just a just-in-time delivery system. So this is a really, really big deal because, you know, they make most of the world's chips for computers that has an AI angle on it. There's a helium story, which also is on that. we have some lot of perturbations going on potentially in the AI story, in computer chips. This applies to South Korea as well. They make a lot of memory chips, and Taiwan's making the CPU chips and all that. So that's just the LNG part of the story. On that, to answer your question directly, so at the Rosslauffen natural gas field refinery area, two things got hit. One of the condensation trains, which is used to turn natural gas into liquefied natural gas. Turns out gases don't like to be liquids. You have to really freeze the heck out of them to turn them back into a liquid. One of those was damaged. That's going to be 3 to 5 years, they said, to fix. And then two, they had a gas to liquids, a GTL plant there, the Shell's big Pearl facility, that was taking natural gas, making it into longer chain stuff and turning it into synthetic, basically, or human manufactured derived, what they call gas oil. And so that was cool technology. That also got damaged. Years. It'll take some years to get that back running. So that was making liquid fuels output. And then the LNG, both of those, just that one facility. We have a bunch of other facilities that have been hit. Each of them has a repair story. Those are probably the longest, worst repair stories, but even more problematic. So Iraq had to do this first. Iraq had only so much storage tanks, you know, those things where the roofs go up and down, the round things. And they got full, and they had to start turning off their oil production as the associated storage for those oil fields filled up. And so they've had to shut in 3 million barrels a day. It's shut down. Good news, when the strait opens, they've got a lot of full tanks to sort of push off into ships, but now they're going to have to restart those oil fields. Here's the problem. Doing an emergency shutdown can really mess that field up. They're very delicate structures. They have carefully managed pressures. They're squeezing it like a balloon, you know, from the edges with water that's being injected. And when you stop that process all of a sudden, that just all sorts to start of do whatever it's doing and breaking down and doing things other than you want it to do. So point is that we won't know how much of the production from those fields has been damaged. Could be zero. In some cases, it could be quite significant. It was producing 1 million barrels a day. Now you can't get it past 750 or 800,000, right? We won't know about that until those get turned back on again. But it's very not advisable to take a functioning oil field and just turn it off. It damages the underground geology in many cases and what it's capable of producing. We'll see. Don't know. But it's going to take probably, even if right now peace broke out, durable, believable, go, everybody get busy. I bet we're looking at 2 to 3 months of severe shortages, minimum.
Okay. And that ripples through the economy, right? That's my point. It's kind of like, look, you've got a car sitting over there and you expect the tires to be completely inflated. This is just a different analogy, right? And you've got something coming at you that you've got to run for your life, but you can't get to that car at this point because of conflict that's taken place. So bottom line is, by the time you get to that car, you might have three tires that are full of air, but that one tire that's going to take some time to pump up could be the difference between getting back immediately or not. It seems like the market is anticipating that car is going to be fueled up, ready, tires, pressure complete. They can jump in it and mash the gas and hit 100 miles an hour real quick. That's just not the case, right?
No, because the first thing is the oil gets pumped out of the ground and it goes into a storage tank, right? And it's held there. And either it goes straight from there into a refinery because you've got an associated refinery that can start having that as throughput. And then the refinery makes things. And then those things go into different tanks, like it might be jet fuel, it might be diesel, it might be gasoline, whatever they're making. And then that gets loaded on a ship. And then there's this endless supply of ships that are just always on the ocean. So think of that as, they called that floating storage. I think Scott Bessent said, oh, there's all this floating storage out there. But once those are all gone, and as we just heard, the last ships that left from the Middle East before the conflict are now arriving at their various ports. And when those are tapped out, they're empty. We have all these empty ships. So that whole floating pipeline has to be refilled before we get back to normalcy. If that makes sense, mm-hmm. Right? And once a refinery can't, you don't just sort of say, oh, we only have half the oil. Let's just run at half capacity. It doesn't quite work that way. So often it's, for some refinery processes, it's all or none, right? That's one level of complexity. The second level of complexity in this is that every refinery is dialed in for a certain grade of crude. I just hate the way even our own energy secretary talks about oil as if it's one thing, like water. Like, mm-hmm. there's only one thing, you know, there's one kind of water, right? There isn't. There's dozens, if not hundreds, of different types of crude. And every refinery on the input side is tuned for something. It likes heavy, sour crude because it's got the scrubbers and it uses sulfur. But more to the point, Paul, downstream, that refinery has customers. It has customers for, let's say I'm a Louisiana heavy sour processing. I have sulfur coming out as a byproduct. I have customers for that sulfur. I have a lot of asphalt coming out of that. I got asphalt companies as customers. I got various types of lubricating oils, paraffins, different waxes. I've got all kinds of different grades of oils. I've got this much diesel, this much gasoline, this much jet fuel coming out of every cut run. And I have customers for all of those. I don't just wake up one day and go, I'll just use some of this light, sweet stuff out of the shale patch, because all of a sudden I have to call my customers and say, I don't have asphalt anymore. You know, sorry, no paraffins, right? It's what people don't realize is there are upwards of 2,000 separate downstream processes that feed off of a given refinery's output. And you don't just change the input feedstock without having to change all the rest of it, too, if that makes sense.
And this is the most important bottleneck in the entire production chain, right? The Strait of Hormuz, what's taking place and coming out of the Middle East. And theoretically, in the U.S., we're sheltered a little bit compared to Asia and Europe. But that bottleneck still ripples. I mean, we still benefit from products that are coming over here, from fertilizer, from what they're producing and everything over there.
Well, and this, again, this complexity is important. I think people need to know about it because, again, we're almost cartoonishly bad descriptions coming out of this administration about this stuff. Oh, we hardly use any oil from the Strait. We'll be fine is a common refrain, they say. That's completely ignorant of how oil markets work. It's a global market. Even if we took 0% from the Gulf, the fact that any oil is impacted from the Gulf drives up oil prices everywhere, unless we're going to shut down our oil trades. We're going to nationalize our oil product. But then you would have to understand, we don't make enough of the kind of oil we need to run our refineries on. So we import still 6 million plus barrels a day of the kind of oil we want. And we export about 3.3 million barrels of the stuff we don't want because it's too light. It's not the stuff we want. So it's all a very complicated, very, very complex system. It works really well until it gets a disruption. And they also say, Paul, they're like, oh, you know, it's 20% of world production, you know, temporary blip. Not accurate. I don't care. Like, if there's a small country somewhere that produces 1 million barrels and consumes 1 million barrels a day, doesn't impact it. Who cares? What matters is that out of 180 countries, about 160 of them are oil importing nations. So what we care about is exportable oil. That's what the world lives on. Every one of those 160 countries needs exportable oil. 35% of the world's exportable oil is what flowed through the Strait of Hormuz on a daily basis. It's much bigger than people are. Oh, it's about 20%. No, it's more than a third. And we're seeing that already. We've heard that Thailand, half their fishing fleet is shut down. They're Singapore, they're telling people to work from home, you know. We're already starting to see the impacts of this ripple out across the afflicted areas.
That's amazing to me. And great explanation. And as you're talking, the only thing that I can think of is, yes, this is going to be ridiculously inflationary in the things that we need, but it's probably going to be deflationary in the things that we want. And that may cause short-term deflation and kind of downside moves in the market. Because you go back to 2008 when oil jumped, completely different circumstance. But that increased price caused demand destruction. People just couldn't afford to travel. They couldn't afford to buy the things that they did. Those just-in-time, you know, that just-in-time cash flow. You know, I tell people all the time, and this is common knowledge for those that are in business, a really profitable business can fail because of lack of cash flow or poor cash flow management. Well, everything's just in time now. So you got private credit that's having problems. And if customers can't afford to, you know, to travel. That's less revenue for restaurants around the country, less revenue in other areas, which could cause some deflationary impact and reduction in earnings because of that cost push inflation, which is very similar to what happened with the price surge of inflation in 1973. You had a market that went from ridiculously overvalued to ridiculously undervalued, even though corporate earnings went up because of the inflationary pressures. So, you know, this is going to be a challenging environment to navigate.
Well, it sure will. And I'm trying to find the chart right now. Give me one more second, because, yes, there's a lot of emphasis on the oil, rightly so. Super important. Also in the natural gas. Very important. I put out so much content on this over the past week, Paul, I'm having trouble remembering where I stashed it.
You put out some great content, and thank you for that.
found it. So it was in the most recent Fatpipe subscription service for my followers. This is what I do, Paul. I get really, I really like to get into the details and understand these things. Great chart here by Katusa. Marin Katusa does really good work showing that, and again, just showing the 20%, that's global supply of crude oil, but as I mentioned, it's 35% of exportable oil, which is actually what we care about. About 20% of LNG, phosphate, it's an important fertilizer component, 20% of that. Helium, 30% to 35% supply shock there. Big deal, because helium is needed for all kinds of things, from MRIs to running labs, have gas chromatographs. You know, it's an amazing number of scientific and high-tech applications require helium to operate. And the reason for that is either for its super cold capability. When you freeze it down, liquefy it, you get some super cold temperatures that allows you to freeze things down, which is important for some things like MRIs. Or it's an inert gas that you're now flooding an environment with, so there's no oxygen, because oxygen can mess up, you know, your chips and things. So there's that. Ammonia, 30%. That's an important fertilizer input. 45% of sulfur, 50% of urea being an important nitrogenous component of the fertilizer trio, NPK. And then left off of this chart also, aluminum. Some real big hits to aluminum over there as well. These are global supply shocks. Paul, any one of these red bars is its own little crisis or big crisis.
Yeah.
What do you do when you have seven? And if I had aluminum, I would have eight red bars we have to deal with here, and possibly some other ones that I've left off here.
And that's something that you have done a phenomenal job warning people, to give them the information to where they hopefully have a strategy where they can make the adaptations as it needs to be made, right? But all I can think about is you look at food costs. I mean, that's something that's been a common conversation around every dinner table or restaurant. You know, you go out and people are just amazed at how expensive the cost of food is. That's a common theme, at least in our area. And then this is going to add on top of that, because we're in the planting season right now, right? You can't make up for that. So I don't know how big a difference that's going to make in the harvest, but that's assuming that you don't get any weather patterns that reduces the harvest or anything else that's caused in there. At a minimum, your transport cost, if it is good, is going to continue to be high because of the knock-on effects. But what happens if you get 40% or 30% or 20% less harvest going into the fall? That's a dramatic increase in the cost of living for the average individual that's really already struggling, with credit card rates going up, default rates on just about everything going up across the board. That's just added pressure to an already stressed system.
Now, it's kind of interesting. Like, here in the U.S., there's almost no conversation about this. I'm not aware of the ag secretary coming out and warning people or doing anything. But over in Europe, the G7's got together, and they're very alarmed, because the farmers communicate more clearly, I guess, with their politicians. And they're alarmed because farmers either can't afford it, can't get access to it, don't have it, they don't know what they're going to do. You know, the Netherlands has this enormous, I think it's the number one food exporter by dollar value, because it's all coated in greenhouses. So they're putting out some pretty high value strawberries and tomatoes and, you know, high value fruits and vegetables. But those greenhouses run on natural gas to heat them, create the carbon dioxide that they use to pump in there, all kinds of stuff. So at a minimum, with natural gas over there now having doubled since this crisis began, probably going higher, unless I miss my mark on this, then we're going to see very, very high food inflation again, just like we saw in 2020-21. Same thing, same dynamic, just driven this time a little bit more broadly because it's both on the input side for fertilizers as well as all the processing and growing costs that go with natural gas. It's a big deal. They're talking about it, at least. They're kind of alarmed, to be honest.
They're talking about it. At least they're talking about it. That's far better than what's taking place in the United States because it's all rah-rah-ree, everything's great, and don't be a panicking, which there are times that is, you know, don't let emotions make your decisions. That's why I have that back there, invest your plan, not your emotions. But there are times that you have to at least capture those emotions and feel them so that you can make those prudent decisions with urgency.
So everybody needs to get ready for that. Paul, when we come back, I want to talk about, it looks like for some reason, foreigners are stepping away from U.S. treasuries. And I think we should take a look at that. Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. Welcome back, everybody. Paul, there's so much to cover because there's just so much going on these days. But I don't know. Do you see this? This is in Financial Times, just came out. Turns out foreign central bank holdings of treasuries at the New York Fed declined. That's this. This is about $100 billion of decline right here. I know it doesn't look like much. There's a lot of wiggles in here, but this is COVID right here. That was a pretty big shock to the system. So obviously selling off all through 2025. Little tiny recovery to the beginning of 2026, but this brings them back to the level of holdings they had back in 2012, when I should note, Paul, our federal debt was half as big as it is currently.
And, you know, I saw that chart and I was just absolutely amazed, but it's not surprising at the same time. I mean, it really isn't. It's just an erosion of trust. And now look, you know, my question is, if you're going to be buying, let's say we walk away from there and Iran opens up the Strait of Hormuz and says, that's fine. We'll let anything go through as long as it's paid for in won or gold. Mm-hmm. Then that's a huge attack on the petrodollar from a long-term standpoint.
Giant. This is actually a very clever strategy to, you know, obviously Iran is the underdog in terms of size, very asymmetric fight. So they're fighting asymmetrically. And what they've done in terms of starting to draw a wedge into that so-called petrodollar, meaning you need dollars to buy oil. And that was sort of on the front end, Paul. You know, people are used to that. Like, if I'm country A and I want to buy oil and you're country B, I have to do it in dollars, right? That's how the system has worked. But then even beyond that, the Gulf states themselves, there was this backroom deal put together by Kissinger, which was like, hey, Saudi Arabia, not only do you want to sell your stuff in dollars, but why do those dollars ever have to even leave the United States? Maybe just you should buy assets over here, like treasuries and stocks, maybe some real estate, your choice, right? So now I think also those Gulf states are feeling pretty aggrieved because I think they feel like the whatever deal they thought they had, which was a, you know, security deal, didn't quite pan out the way they thought. So they may not be as incentivized to keep that whole petrodollar arrangement going at this point in time. I could easily see that. So This could be a quick accelerant to the loss of the dollar's role, both in oil and also in reserve. These are central bank holdings, central banks of the world collectively. When you add up the number all at once, and I'd love to see minutia under that to find out which central banks were responsible for selling, maybe which ones are still buying. But it for sure, the United States, U.S. Treasury has less cachet, less...
Right.
It's less promising to these central banks than it was just a couple years ago.
And as long as they're reinvesting into our treasuries, then our line of credit continues to expand. And then all of a sudden, our behavior gets to the point where the bank says no more, or the economy gets to the point where the bank says no more. That wipes out a lot of companies that are running on the edge. You know, they just don't have that cash flow to float it anymore. So my concern is that another potential knock-on effect that we're not going to be able to continue this fiscal irresponsibility and these deficits because the rest of the world is just not going to recycle back into our treasuries, which means higher interest rates on our debt unless the government just monetizes it, which causes a currency crisis in our situation. Or what happens if they cut back all the fiscal excess and this borrowing from the future to party today? That's a dramatic impact. And look, I've said it before. I'm really concerned that the baby boomer generation has ridden this wave, you know, of being able to allow our leaders to make foolish decisions for short-term benefit at long-term expense. And I'm really concerned that especially those that are convinced that passive is the way to go, or they're fully convinced that the U.S. can never have anything go wrong, that they're going to be delivered a painful blow at the absolute worst time when they need that money, that capital that they've spent their life setting aside the most. That's my biggest concern. That's why I believe that a risk managed approach is so crucial at this point, because it is the path less traveled.
Totally agree. And I do wish that whatever the mechanisms are that just sort of continually rescue stocks at critical moments and bonds and all that, I wish that it was more honest so that people could get a sense of the real risk here. Like, I feel like risk is badly mispriced in this market right now. I could be wrong, but that's my sense of it because of some of the data we've gone through. I go through a lot more than this. That there's so much coming out right now. But again, Paul, we have 8 red bars, any one of which is like a giant crisis, and that should be sending signals out there, right? It just ought to be sending signals out there. And I'm scouring. The only thing I can find is, you know, some of the oil majors started to like march up pretty decisively at the beginning of January for reasons that were unclear to me, but now maybe they're more clear what they were sniffing out there. But I'm seeing other things which just seem lobotomized to me, like grain prices in the U.S., all of them, wheat, corn, oats, rice, exactly the same as they were at the beginning of March. And we can clearly see there's going to be a global issue at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What am I supposed to take from that dead flat pricing? The U.S. is going to not sell grain to the rest of the world, so we'll have plenty? I don't get it. I don't understand what's happening there. But normally, let me tell you a quick story. So Chernobyl happens. I was reading this great account of it. And within 10 minutes of sort of like the first alert being coming out, potato futures in Poland took off like you wouldn't believe. And they chased that story down, this reporter, and they found that there was some guy who's really dialed in, and he found out that radiation, you know, something had happened. He looked at the weather pattern, saw that it was going to go over the potato growing regions, quickly figured out that this was probably going to impact, like, you know, we're going to not eat those potatoes. Potatoes are going to go up in price. That's how a market works. Information gets processed. Yes. So fast, you can't even believe it.
Yes.
That's how it used to work. Now I'm watching some, like, takes months for the market to sort of catch on to something now. I don't get it anymore. It's kind of, it's a weird place.
Well, that was a period of time where the market was all-knowing and the market was smart and the participants together were making decisions in little nodes around the world, and it reacted to that. But when you've got a passive environment, nobody's looking into the future. Right? Nobody's looking into the future. It's just like, hey, I'm going to do this because it's worked in my short period of time looking in the rearview mirror. And my experience, you know, that's the problem. And that's why I get so upset that our schools do not focus on history. Learn, you know, so that we can learn from the mistakes of the past, because cycles are a real thing. And these cycles last for generations sometimes, right? I mean, think about, especially the baby boomers, a lot of the listeners that are out there can remember how their parents were abhorred debt, right? because my grandfather's generation came through the Great Depression. They understood how painful debt is when the economy has a deflationary cycle. So they, you know, and I can't tell you how many times even my uncle's talking about it. He's like, you know, if my grandfather, you know, dad had been a little bit more aggressive, he could have accumulated more wealth, but he refused to go get himself extended into debt. Business debt was one thing, but not personal debt. Now we've got a whole generation that their entire experience has been nothing but asset prices increasing. Well, yeah, you paid 17% on your mortgage back in the early 1980s, but the reality is we had the wind at our sails during that period of time, and as interest rates came down, house prices went up because people could make more payments and more payments. Now, apparently in the rearview mirror, we've seen the bottom of that interest rate cycle, so the question is, what's it going to be like in the future as that reverse takes place? And there's a lot of lessons in history. And I don't think you're wrong. I mean, just the mathematics you look at, this market is not taking into consideration the risks that are out there. It is ridiculously overvalued from history. And there's not been a time where the general valuation in the S&P 500 has been this expensive in history that we've actually had positive returns over the following 10 years. But I think the problem is we're so short-term in our gratification today that people assume because it's not happening the moment that they hear the news that it's not coming. And that's not reality. The seeds of the trouble in the future are being sowed and fertilized with what's taking place in the Middle East right now. It's just going to take some time to produce that fruit, and that fruit's not going to be good.
Right. Well, remember I showed you like the German stock market ticking up with ours just merrily, like, you know, showed all those combined charts. This also just came out day before yesterday in Bloomberg. And it's pointing out that the headline is pressure mounts on Europe diesel supply as tankers turn away. And it turns out that you track these tankers that left here from the Gulf Coast in the U.S. Came and they were heading up and they were turned Florida and they were merrily heading towards Europe. Oh, no, they all went the other way. So Europe got outbid for diesel, right? Diesel is how Europe operates. Every one of those tankers represents now more supply shock, less economic activity. It ought to have some sort of impact, you would think, on how people perceived equity shares over there. But nope, they're trading tick for tick currently with U.S. shares for some reason, you know. So I guess I'm a little bit salty about it, Paul. Markets used to be my early warning system. So I'm an information scout, you know, over at Peak Prosperity. And so I always had certain... there's certain things that I have running as charts over on the side and if something happens there instantly, I now go searching for the news because I know something's up, right? So if insurance companies start tanking or if it's financials start tanking or somebody's really, you know, I see Exxon's, you know, or some other energy shares skyrocketing, like it tells me something. I feel like they've sort of neutered the information processing capability of the markets. They're not as useful as they used to be.
No, they're not. But only in the sectors that benefit them or in the way that it benefits them, right? Like when energy starts moving, the question is, you know, why all of a sudden? Well, we come to find out that there are obviously people on the inside who knew and were positioning themselves to profit from that. But if you allow oil prices to go higher from here, that's not necessarily good for their political career or their polling numbers and the knock-on effects that can happen from private equity that's already in the midst of a crisis from everything that you can see taking place around the edges. So there is signal when people move for their own benefit, but there's not honest signal for the overall market where individuals can protect themselves and make adaptations.
Well, I just think this is really important time for people to you know, pay attention, understand what the data actually is telling you out there right now. Make your own interpretations around that. I just can't trust what anybody tells me at this point because information is the new battlefield, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
X or formerly Twitter is an information battlefield right now. Got to be very careful about who you listen to, and even good people sometimes pass along what turns out to be AI generated junk. Mainstream news, same thing. They've got a point of view. They've got some products they're selling, mostly points of view, which is their products. It's getting harder and harder to sort of figure it out. So I just go by the actual data, the core data. Here's my core data. there's really basically no oil coming out of the strait right now. Mm-hmm. We're missing 12 million barrels a day. Every day that that ticks on is going to be an inflationary add-on at some point down the road. So we have, at the time of this recording, about 31 days of that pressure, and every day is, just adds to that. That's all I can really trust right now.
And watches as it comes along. And one thing, you know, every now and then I come across something. I love quotes because there's so much wisdom with them. And sometimes they come across at the right time. And I had written this down probably 4 years ago, and I was going through some papers today and found it. So there's an old Chinese proverb that says, if you must play, decide on three things at the start. So I'm going to add, if you must play a game, decide on three things at the start: the rules of the game, the stakes, and the quitting time. Okay? Now, I've said this before, when it comes to the markets, we can't control the rules of the game. We have to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us. But you can do it prudently, okay? So we know we have to play by the game, by the rules that are forced upon us, and we make adaptations for that. We have in our investment strategy. Now, the most important thing right now is the stakes. Okay, so what are the stakes? And that's one thing that passive investors specifically need to ask themselves. What if it's not different this time? Okay, what if this has been a distorted period of time and we're going to still have economic cycles? Okay, so let me share two charts that would be good. This is not a very good visual to share, but it's still important information. So I'll try to talk everybody through the chart as best I can here. So what this is current market valuation. It's a service that just goes through and they aggregate a market value index. They combine some of them together. So what we're looking at right now is of March 27th, we're currently overvalued, right? Like that's running a red line. That means you're priced for perfection. Okay. Now down here, and I can't take my mouse and put it over on the right-hand side, is the aggregate market value index model going back through history. That goes all the way back to, that's right behind my camera there. So what, 1960 or so, 1962 is where it starts. Now, one thing we can notice is at the top, that's plus two standard deviations. So that's strongly overvalued. What you notice here is if I come down, that was close to May 31st of the year 2000. Okay, that's pretty close to that top. On the left-hand side, which if I move my mouse to, I'll lose it, that was May 31st of the year 2000. Your actual 10-year S&P 500 subsequent return was a 23% loss. Now, in the midst of that, you had a 47% decline in the S&P from 2000 to 2003. You get back to even in 2008, and then you have a 57, I think, top to bottom. But the actual return for 10 years was negative 23%. Okay, so that was actual history. Now, let's go back here and let's look at the 1968. Okay, so in history, right, mathematics, there's people that argue that valuations are going to stay higher now. Okay, maybe they are. But in 1968, you know, we hit this overvalued, not strongly overvalued. On the left-hand side, if I move my mouse, you'll lose it. December 31st, 1968, the actual 10-year return from there was a negative 7% return in the S&P. Now, this is where we have been. We set the all-time high here recently in the past year, and I can't move my mouse small enough to hit it. And we're just barely off that top with a little bit of the market selling off. Okay, so, you know, my point is, this is the riskiest time for the markets, and everything is not firing on all cylinders. So the question you have to ask yourself is, what are the stakes? Okay, we know from where we were in the past, the stakes were negative 23% return over the following year. In 1968, we weren't this expensive. You know, you had negative returns for 10 years. So that's one thing to take into consideration. Mathematics are just showing that the stakes are ridiculously high. Now, I want to show another chart. Hang on, let me pull it up so you guys don't have to see me shifting through. To say, what are the stakes to the downside? So this black line right here is the S&P 500 going all the way back to 1925 or 26. It's a busy chart, but that red dotted line that we see right here, that's a price-earnings ratio of 20. Okay, so you're paying 20 times the earnings of the company going forward. That's considered an expensive market. Blue is fair value. That's price earnings ratio of 15. And green is that once in a generation opportunity to aggressively invest when the market gets down there. So one thing I want to point out is we cycle. You know, coming out of the Great Depression and World War II, we got expensive in the 60s, stayed there for a while, and then all of a sudden in the 70s, we dropped way down. That's what we talked about earlier with that inflationary impulse. But let's jump forward to where we are today. S&P, as of yesterday's close or today, is 6,597. So what are the stakes? The stakes are just to get back to an overvalued market. That's what, a 30% decline? Okay. Just to get back to a fairly valued market, that's a 42, just nearly a 50% decline. And to get back to an undervalued market, which we've not seen since the 1970s, but remember, what did we have in the 1970s? An oil issue,
oil shock,
oil crisis. Oil shock that occurred, not as severe as what this one is. That's a 70% decline in the S&P 500. Now, that's major. So my point being is, you know, don't say that'll never happen, because the reality is that is the stakes of the game that investors are playing right now. And then the last thing to take into consideration is, what's the quitting time? Okay, if you're passive in your investing process, you have no quitting time. It doesn't matter if there's three nukes in the air headed our way, or you know for a fact 6 months from now that this market's going to be down 70%. Somebody has a time machine, a crystal ball, and they tell you 6 months from now the market's going to be down 50%. If you're in a passive investing strategy, there is no sell, right? It's only when you need the money. Well, what's going to happen if that reality comes home to roost and the stakes are actually that severe? And you sell when you need the money, that means you probably lost your job. You probably can't get access to credit. Even if you're retired, you still need your monthly income. So you're forced to sell at the absolute worst time. So that Chinese proverb carries forward to the strategy that we employ, and that anybody should. Now, it takes time to develop the wisdom and the application and learn these strategies and strengths of weaknesses. But it can be done. And the point is, what is your quitting time? Okay. That line in the sand that says, I'm going to embrace volatility and I'm going to hold this until this event happens and I have a quitting time. So, you know, based on that Chinese proverb, and one thing about the Chinese is they're very good. You know, Sun Tzu's art of war, they're very good long-term thinkers. They try to seek wisdom from that standpoint. You know, if you must play the game, decide on the three things, the rules of the game. We can't control those, but we can play by the rules forced upon us. The stakes, we clearly demonstrated that the downside risk, if this doesn't work out perfectly, is substantial, in the quitting time. The question is, do you have a quitting time, right? Where you exit those markets, you protect that capital, or you exit the markets and protect the capital and you take, you know, you peel some off the top, beef up your savings, you stock up on a little bit of food, you know, you make prudent decisions from a long-term standpoint. Now, I'll say this, we're not fully quit of the game right now, but we have exited the game in several circumstances. We've raised the most amount of cash over the past couple of months that we've had in quite some time in the portfolio outside of early 2022. And that's one thing we're going to continue to do as the information comes along, is we're going to exit that volatility, protect that capital, and look, we may be wrong, but what's, you know, missed opportunity for short periods of time is easier to make up for than lost capital. Because if you lose 50% of your portfolio, it takes 100% return to get back to even. And Chris, you might remember this because you're so good at math in the short run. I can't remember. But if you're down 70%, if I remember correctly, you've got to make somewhere around 150% to get back to even. You know, so if we reset the system and market valuations come down and you go back to that 10% a year return that they tell you that you should expect in the overall market, that's 10 years to get back to even. If it's 150%, that's 15 years back to even. So, I mean, that's the only warning, the most important warning that I can give investors right now. Know what you own, why you own it, or at least your advisor know what you own and why you own it. I know exactly why we own what we do in each of our investment strategies and why our clients have there. What are the stakes of the path that you're on? If it's passive, the stakes could be 50 to 70% loss. Who knows whether that'll occur or not, but that's the reality of the stakes. Okay. And you can't remove the reality of the circumstances because history clearly teaches us that we're in a precarious situation. So if you're in a precarious situation and you're priced to perfection, the question is, when I look into the future, do I see anything that could derail priced for perfection? And oh my gosh, there's a list a mile long right now. Like I always keep a list of risks for the market and benefits for the market, like the scales of justice. The risks for the market right now far outweigh the benefits to the market. So you really have to be a gambler or speculator at this moment in time to assume that we're going to get perfection. Maybe we do. Okay. Maybe there's a rabbit that Trump can pull out of his hat somehow and the Secretary of Dissent, but we all are human. And my concern is, you know, history teaches us that pride comes before the fall. And boy, there's a lot of pride in the halls of power right now.
You remind me, Paul, I heard this from Grant Williams. He said, you know how you lose 90% off a portfolio? First you lose 80% and then you lose 50% of that.
Oh, that's good. I forgot that he said, I remember hearing that or hearing you say it before, but that's really good. It puts it into perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and that's why, of course, everybody should be, you know, have a clearly defined plan because often, I mean, you know, we all heard this during 2008, you know, my 401k jokingly became a 201k and people wouldn't open their, went back when we had these things called envelopes that came in the mail that showed you your portfolio performance, people wouldn't open them because they didn't want to know. They just didn't want to see that information. But you have to have a strategy, understanding what these risks are. And I had just found this just the other day. This is comparing historical concentration peaks. You were just showing overvalued, but this is concentration of the market. So we had the Nifty 50. It hit peaked out at about 40% of the S&P 500. Of course, that fell way back, and that was one of those periods of time back there in the 60s and the 70s that you had noted, right? Where, yeah, once the Nifty 50, you know, took a dive, it took 10 years to get kind of back to even, right, at that point in time. Similarly, we have Japan peaked out here about 1988. It took them, gosh, I think it was 88 all the way to 2025 or 4 to get back to
35
even.
35 years. 35 yep. years.
And then we have tech.
34.
34, yeah. And then we have the tech telecom here, boom, 2000, and you mentioned that one. That took 10 years to get back to even. And here we are at the exact same concentration, 40, 44, 41, 41, hike. You know, and this is the AI Big Ten current concentration. But, Paul, this time's different. This time is different.
Every generation thinks it's different. And unfortunately, you know, when I read the Bible through, I feel so sorry for the prophets. Right. Many of those prophets just absolutely warned the society of what was coming. And a lot of them didn't see the full fruition in their lifetime. And I think a lot of that is just God's mercy. Wall Street wants to make fun of people. Well, if you're too early, you're wrong. Well, look, you can warn people of something early. And there's some truth to that. OK, But you can warn people. But just because you're warning people doesn't necessarily mean your portfolio is positioned for it immediately. OK, but there is mercy in warning people and giving them plenty of time to prepare. Because, look, the average person out there, 70% of the population, doesn't have 3 months' worth of savings on hand. They don't. Most of them, and that was 3 years ago when I was looking at that data, and I would say it's even worse today, right? So those individuals, 70% of the population, can't just go buy 3 months' worth of food at the snap of a finger. Right? So it takes time for them to do that. What they can do is make some prudent decisions in the interim period and say, hey, market's priced for perfection. I've had some really good returns because I've been passive and ridden through this. How about I sweep some off the top and get myself in a more resilient position? Worst case scenario, I miss a little bit of opportunity. Okay? But if history is any has any lessons to offer, and I do believe that it does, because like the Optimist Creed is one of my favorites, just one line I'll hold on to. Learn from the mistakes of the past and press on to the greater achievements of the future. You know, learn from other people's mistakes. We've shown all kinds of historical mistakes here. And look, to go back to Japan, I mean, just think about it. Chris, you remember all the, you know, that was a period of time where I was studying in high school and early college, you know, kind of the after effects of that. But, you know, Japan was just the wonder of the world at that period of time. And nobody thought anything could go wrong with the Japanese index. So from 1983, there was a 378% increase in the Nikkei index, right? So this is the Nikkei index going back to 1977 on a monthly chart. And then it cratered, and then it cratered, you know. But look, you had that first big sell-off, and then there's your dip buyers. They didn't know anything else, so they piled in. It rallied, made them feel good, and then it collapsed. And then they piled in, and then it rallied, and then, you know, it bounces around. Then you get that final big collapse into 2003, a little bit of hope, and then you retest that bottom there. And then, of course, 34 years later, you know, before you get even. It's not outside the realm of possibility that that happens to the U.S. markets, because China's the manufacturing powerhouse. Asia, there's a lot of wealth in other countries. They don't have the debt level that we do. They could initiate the game of accumulating their debt and buy, you know, create a cycle over there. So it's very important for investors to be adaptable and have some strategies that can guide them. There may come a day where it makes sense to where a U.S. investor is very underweighted the U.S. markets and overweighted the others. And I mean, even from 2000 to 2012, including the decline of 2008, a U.S. investor was better to be overweight commodities and emerging markets and international markets. And I do believe that we have already started that cycle again to where commodities, emerging markets, and international markets are going to outperform the U.S. You know, hindsight will tell us for sure, but all the data is telling me that's where the opportunity is over the next 7 to 10 years, not necessarily the U.S. markets.
Well, I think everybody's going to need to operate with prudence and also going to have to be nimble if we're going to get in front of this inflationary train that's clearly coming. As I mentioned, you know, that's already in the pipeline. It's coming down the tracks, you know, whatever the metaphor is here. And so if you want to talk with someone in Paul's team or Paul himself to figure out how you can have a risk managed portfolio strategy, please go to peakfinancialinvesting.com and fill out the simple form. And within 48 business hours, somebody from Paul's team will get a hold of you and you can schedule the first of three different sessions, an introductory call, a planning call, and then if it goes FR, recommendation call. And if all works out, maybe it makes sense to work together. So again, peakfinancialinvesting.com. And everybody really should, it's time to get prudent and cautious here, I believe. So with that, Paul, thank you so much for your time today, buddy.
It's my honor, Chris. Good to see you. Stay nimble.
All right, you too. Bye for now, everybody. See you next time.